This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we are to talk about in this episode include...
Dinosaur Flying Aces.
Chinese Gangsters in Oklahoma.
The Who Done It Wobble.
And the Ghost Murmur Device.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And today, Robin, I don't want to overexcite you, but today's miniatures are the best kind of miniatures because half of them are dinosaurs, and the other half of them are World War I aircraft. Frankly, if one's inner nine-year-old is not blissful at that thought, then one needs to have a chat with one's inner nine-year-old and get back to basics. That's what I say. Because you have suggested, as our topic for the Gaming Hut, Dinosaur Flying Aces, and I assume the role-playing game. If this is going to be a board game design, I will lose interest, but not entirely.
The board game already exists, I assume.
Yes, having looked they it all up, do.
Must have. And presumably Ameritrash, I would guess, would be my category for that.
If Reiner Knizia has designed Dinosaur Flying Aces, the board game, well, let me say there is still space in the field then for someone else to do it.
Right. And astute listeners may remember several episodes ago during Ken's bookshelf when, due to a serendipitous confluence of books on your bookshelf, I blurted out the phrase Dinosaur Flying Aces. Therefore, we are now going to brainstorm for around 15 minutes what a Dinosaur Flying Aces role-playing game would look like. And so the first question before us, Ken, is, are these flying aces who are riding dinosaurs, or are they dinosaurs who are flying aces?
Right.
So what do you think the people want? Like, forget what we want. We're servants of the people as game designers.
Exactly. Exactly.
What do the people want?
Well, I think the people would probably like to play both dinosaurs and humans. And so, therefore, I think that there should be a powerful set of options, one of them being the small man-sized Troodon dinosaur that can fly, albeit, I suppose, with some modification of the seat, a standard World War I aircraft, some of them being the enormous flying dinosaurs, your Pteranodons, your Quetzalcoatluses, etc., and some of them being dinosaurs that it is physically impossible to lift off the ground with World War I level engine technology, Triceratops T-Rex, who nonetheless are probably on a dirigible of some kind, or maybe a heavy bomber that we simply turn into a gunship instead of a bomber, merely as an excuse to explain why it is being flown by a Stegosaurus instead of by a German. What does that sound like, Robin?
Yes, I think that's exactly what people want. And I guess we have to figure out, do we have to figure out why there are dinosaur flying aces, or is it just a conceit? Do we just buy into that, or do we explain the weird science that is involved that has possibly evolved at least some of the dinosaurs? I mean, we know velociraptors can, you know, open certain types of door handle. They can truly operate a command stick. But are some of them at least uplifted dinosaurs? If you want to play them, right, they would have to be intelligent in some way, right?
Yeah, if you're playing them, then they need to be human level or thereabouts intelligence. I think the simplest way to do it, and we can, of course, make it as complex as we want, but this is not the backstory game, I feel. This is about
getting us... Yeah, you don't want to open this up and go, 100,000 years ago, the Sumerians first. Yeah, we don't want that.
No. What we want is an Edgar Rice Burroughs-type lost world discovered in Antarctica. It's a warm plateau. It's full of dinosaurs. Some of the dinosaurs, like the troodons, have developed intelligence. There is a magic ray or crystal that can uplift other dinosaurs. They use them on their servants. The troodons are battled against by the velociraptors, who, of course, take the side of Germany. And the two warring tribes of dinosaurs immediately join up with imperial powers and then are drawn into World War One. And because they are dinosaurs and live for a mighty combat, they rapidly rise to the top ranks of aces. And also because they are perhaps a little better armored than they were in boring old geology, they can take to the skies against a craft. And if I did a little of the back of the envelope math, the Quetzalcoatlus has a wingspan larger than that of a World War One fighter. It has a 35-foot wingspan, maybe up to double that, depending on which paleontologist you believe. It weighs around 500 pounds, and it can go maybe 80 miles an hour, and that is easily able to mix it up with a Fokker triplane or a Sopwith Camel, which have respectively a 24 and a 28-foot wingspan, top speeds of 110 and 113. So I think that we're in a space where certainly early in the war, and then the Quetzalcoatlus can get improved with a germplasm or vivifying drugs or rays or whatever, so that it can stay, you know, as good as the late war craft. Pteranodons, likewise, 21-foot wingspan and can go 20 miles an hour. That's 1914 level, but I assume super pteranodons or hyper pteranodons are possible given World War One era mad science and a will. And of course, we will have that will.
Right.
So we are capable of engaging in all manner of mix-em-ups, from people riding dinosaurs to dinosaurs carrying machine guns crouched in their belly to full-on dinosaur pilots of regular World War One aircraft. I think that all those possibilities exist.
Right. And so I think character generation-wise that you definitely, everybody's going to want to have some flying capable character, whether they're a pilot or a flying dinosaur or a dinosaur who pilots a plane, because the aerial clashes are going to be a big part of this. This might not be something that you would run a 7-year campaign of, but you might run a nice little a mini campaign until you get tired of the aerial battle being the end of every session. But, you know, having a battle at the end of every session is already a role-playing trope. So you just have to find a way to mix it up each time. Now, we could possibly also have a troop style thing where you also play a mechanic or a civilian operative at the base or
a dinosaur groom, right?
Right.
Like the cavalry has grooms for their mounts. So the groom, the person whose job it is to keep a dinosaur who has maybe been perhaps imperfectly uplifted by their ray, you know, on point. And so you have to be BFFs with your dinosaur. And in the Romantasy era, God knows what else that means, but thank God there won't be mechanics for it because this is about aerial combat. But, you know, I'm sure that there is a popular PDF that comes out right after this that someone else writes for it.
Right. Yeah. We'll leave that to their imagination.
Exactly. So
the source material, movies about World War One pilots, basically tend to be about drama at the base, then going out for the big fight and the people dealing with the fact that there is an extremely high casualty rate, that you would lose somebody on every run, I don't know if that actually really goes with the loopy concept. So do we want to have an element of sort of soap opera at the base, or do we want to have sort of a Star Trek thing where we're mixing ground level activities, like adventuring activities rather than dramatic activities, with the flying activities? So would, for example, are we going to have scenarios where there are paratroopers and, you know, that's your Triceratops and your big dirigible drops you behind enemy lines, and then do perform your mission and then get picked up, so that we're alternating aerial combat with commando action.
The paradigmatic air adventure pulp story, which I fully grant no one less old than me has ever read, is a sort of a spy story, adventure type story. Sometimes there's a saboteur in the base, and sometimes there's some sort of mysterious craft that you have to learn how to shoot down. And so I feel like there is room certainly for on ground adventure, maybe not quite so much landing party, because what we don't want is to get into the trenches. What we want to do is stay in the beautiful sky.
Right. If we answer the question, what would Velociraptors do to trench warfare? We're probably have a completely different war going on and right. A completely different alternate history.
Although you do bring up a point that we can absolutely get away with having some sort of emotional / shock rules. And from that, I think we can add, you know, some capacity for the game to cover the drama of, we don't know if Stega Johnny's coming back from this one. He's had a lot of luck. And also we can have, I know that we're different phyla, but by God, I love you, giant crinoid pilot.
Yes. No, not in the aforementioned way, in the comradely way.
In the comradely way, yes, absolutely. But melting glance across the tarmac. And so we can have those as possible sorts of play, because I think that the general notion is strong enough. And to sidebar briefly, Will Hindmarch and I long ago thought of doing a Pendragon spinoff that was World War I combat, and the notion that you're doing your ground-based adventures, which would have been sort of spy commando adventures, and then the aerial battle is sort of your joust or your knightly combat. And I feel like something of that rhythm could inhere in Dinosaur Flying Aces.
Right. I guess the next thing we need to do is to make the human characters somewhat balanced against the dinosaur characters. Obviously, one thing that they can do that a large or flying dinosaur can't is the more mission-oriented things where you have to pass as human, right? Because
right. Yeah.
A pteranodon is not going to sneak into the base to get the papers. A Tyrannosaurus is going to be kind of visible for miles. Mm-hmm. And so you need the humans to do the human stuff. So you need them along on the trip and with your Tyrannosaur hiding behind a really tall tree, mm-hmm. in order to stomp in and, you know, save your bacon if you happen to get caught in your mission. It could also be that the dinosaurs are more resistant to shell shock, to trauma, than humans are, because, they're literally cold-blooded. So they are, somewhat more inured to the whole tooth and claw thing. And so they're like, your buddy died. Too bad. Yeah. Did anyone remember to scavenge his corpse for carrion?
To eat him at all? That would help.
Yeah, he had a lot of calories. So you could get, a lot of fun in with the different viewpoints of the dinosaurs versus the humans. You could also characterize the different types of dinosaurs as having different fun personalities to play, so that your herbivore would be more calm and phlegmatic than your carnivore. And we don't need to explain to players what shtick they would be doing as a velociraptor, right?
It's right, like, yeah.
And even though you've put the velociraptors on the other side, there have to be some free German velociraptors who have,
right. Yeah. It's like the Czech Legion that fought nobly for the Allies. You know, they're technically part of the Central Powers, but not these are Utah raptors, and they are proudly Mormons. And so they serve with America. I think that another way, and I do love your idea of the troop. I think that troop style play is key for this, so that everyone can play at least one dinosaur and one people, and maybe one pilot and one ground specialist as well. So maybe you start with a panel of four characters. But the other notion is that the discovery of dinosaur land in Antarctica is going to, as I mentioned, there's a ray, there's a crystal. So it opens the door for sort of mad science, you know, germplasm upgrades, that kind of stuff. Dr. Moreau out there busily sewing lion arms onto people, whatever. And so you have the possibility for your people to be augmented a bit. So maybe they can't go one-on-one with a T-Rex, but they can throw down with a velociraptor or even a few velociraptors and maybe have a chance of getting out. So it becomes a little pulpy Super Z type in feel for some of your human characters, other human characters, because one assumes being augmented with weird World War One mad science is hard on the old shock system, if yes. I were to just guess.
And we could introduce the idea that being raptorized, getting super soldier serum derived from velociraptors injected into you is sort of one of those sort of threshold things. It's like, so do you go for an additional dose and make your scales harder with all of the different psychic destabilizing effects of that, right? Are you velociraptors, they're used to being velociraptors. They're not going to go berserk when faced with a strange stimuli. But you just grew these scales a couple of months ago. You're not maybe ready for your big claws to sprout in the middle of a mission or your jaw to radically distend and the teeth to start popping out. And so that can be a thing where if you go down the road of that type of character, you're always rolling to determine whether you've got the exact degree of hybridization. Well, it's not hybridization, but people, we know what we mean here.
Yeah.
Your exact degree of raptorization can change under stress, and you have to sort of carefully calibrate that. And, you know, maybe if you've sprouted claws that your fiancé is going to be discommoded by, you may need to go back to base and try and get the docs to reverse it. And they may be able to do that for a while, but you never know when they're going to pop out again.
They're going to pop back out, and you're going to be forever have to take to the skies because it's the only place you can still feel human.
So finally, the question that we don't really concern ourselves with a lot, but that other people all want the answer to, is what system? So obviously, I think we need a game system that has a really robust contest system in order to make aerial combat fun. You could, you know, break out an entirely different subsystem. You know, you can play Ace of Aces, I suppose, if you, you know, then make about 12 different dinosaur versions of that. But we don't want to get too bogged down in minutiae because it's a crazy pulp game. So I don't think we want to go like the GURPS direction, but also probably something that is more contesty than Gumshoe, because I don't think investigation is going to be much of a part of
as
this.
As big a part. And we could just still keep the Gumshoe investigation rules for the spy missions when they do happen. But by the way, a big Eddie Rickenbacker salute to anyone who does play this in GURPS. I think that you'll have shot down a Luftwaffe's worth of problems when you're done.
Yes, it will definitely have solved this problem for you in one of its many books.
But exactly. And I would say that if I were doing this from the jump, I would start with Savage Worlds, because the sweet spot for Savage Worlds is exactly the sort of frenetic action that this sort of universe partakes of. And I would start there, and then if you need to sort of add a little granularity for your different types of dinosaur, you need some other stuff, look at that. But I would begin with Savage Worlds and then add, as we mentioned, that sort of emotional component to it, so that it's more than just, did you make your grit roll? Did you not make your grit roll? It becomes an emotional slider a little closer, as I indicated, to Pendragon, where, you know, you have these choices that are being sort of forced on you, either by your dinosaur nature or by the chivalry of the air. And you have to, you know, do things against maybe your best interests, because it's World War One. The whole thing is against your best interests. And then that's also where you can insert your Dinomantasy stuff, which I believe some part of the people want, even if you and I are maybe not the people to immediately provide it.
You've mentioned it a lot for someone who's completely uninterested in it.
I'm interested in the people who want it because, Robin, I am a giver. And I am
a servant of the people, as previously described. Well, right. I can hear the ankylosaur dinosaurs roaring overhead. So I think it's time for us to duck and cover into another hut and or segment.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page-Turner shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The fingerprint array on the wall, the mugshots, and the filing cabinets full of cold case files tell us we're once more in proximity to the crime blotter, where we look at all matters illegal and against the law. And in this case, a beloved Patreon backer, Jake Moss, asks for a home state crime blotter on the Chinese mob in the Oklahoma drug market. How does a Chinese mafia shootout in an Oklahoma cornfield feature in a gumshoe scenario? So, Ken, you're the native Oklahoman here, so why don't you start us off with some home state background detail?
Okay. Oklahoma has always been something of a backwater in criminal terms. I mean, not that they didn't have criminals, it's just that they weren't wired into a national chain. Tulsa was part of the Kansas City mob. Oklahoma City was an open town run by locals, and I remember in my youth reading the occasional newspaper article about Philadelphia businessman found dead in the Canadian River and no one knows why. Shrug. We don't know. Maybe this is because Murray the Camel Humphreys of the Chicago outfit had a second home in Norman, Oklahoma from the 30s.
And let's all pause to savor the magic of that nickname.
And let's all pause to savor the magic of Capone's Welsh Fixer having a second home in Oklahoma. It's all magical. He gets divorced from his Oklahoman wife in 1957, so he's there less often before his 1965 death. But prohibition in Oklahoma only ends in 1959. It was a dry state until then, so there was ample opportunity for local bootleggers to run things. But again, there just wasn't a lot of money in Oklahoma for big city bootleggers to do things, and our local boys had it pretty locked down. There was a group of heisters and hoods called the Little Dixie Mafia, and this Little Dixie is the southeastern part of the state, and so they ran things out of various southeastern Oklahoma towns, and what they would do is they would listen on police scanners for news of other outlaws, other bad guys, and they would use their connections with the larger mafia world to identify people who had gotten a little too big for their britches, were running too good an organization, and then they'd go kill them and take all their stuff. And so there was sort of a native predator that also kept big out-of-town outfits out. So we had Mexican cartels come through, especially after the 80s. We had a Russian crime wave a little bit, but by and large, it was local and unlinked crime syndicates until 2018, when the state of Oklahoma legalized growing weed for in-state medicinal purposes. And all you needed to grow weed in Oklahoma under their law is a local owner of the grow and a medical license, which is, say, a license to grow medical marijuana. You didn't have to be a doctor to do it. And criminals could easily obtain those, just as they can obtain virtually anything that can be obtained with money.
Right. And the difference between what Oklahoma does and every other jurisdiction and why this happens here is not just the open ecological niche left by the relatively low-key crime scene, but the fact that the Oklahoma legislation doesn't think to put any sort of cap whatsoever on the number of licensed grow ops. So that little bit of laissez-faire allows something pretty big to, grow under some hydroponic lights.
And also, Oklahoma has, you know, wide open spaces, low density, which makes it ideal for doing illegal things on the other side of the back 40. It excellent growing conditions. I remember one of my friends proudly telling me in the 1970s that he'd come back from a New York head shop and it had a t-shirts for sale that said, "Thank God for Adair County, Oklahoma." And so we may not be the Humboldt County, California, but we're certainly a good domestic location for it and a central location.
Right. This won't be the first time New York comes up in this discussion.
So if you're shipping bales of weed to other states, especially to states slower to legalize weed, Oklahoma is a great place to start for that. And in this period, in the 2020s, they were estimating 3,000 illicit grows generating between $18 and $40 billion a year. And that's billion with a B, which means oil and gas are the biggest industry in Oklahoma, illegal weed, the second biggest industry in Oklahoma. So with that kind of money, stuff starts happening. And it starts happening mostly with a 14K triad, which is a Chinese triad that coalesced around the Kuomintang presence in South China. After the Kuomintang is kicked out of China by Mao, their headquarters moves to Hong Kong, and they move into Burma to grow and sell opium. And that's starting in 1950. They basically are what puts the gold in the golden triangle, and they have been running drug operations basically ever since. And after the immigration laws in America change in 1965, they begin coming to America, because why wouldn't you? America is the greatest place in the world to come, even if you are a triad.
They have the expertise and they see a fertile market, and in this case, fertile fields.
Right. And so they mostly operate out of New York. The local headquarters of the 14K now is in Flushing in Queens, and Fujian is where they originated, and it's where they still are because everyone's family is still back there. And so their basic model is they use snakehead human traffickers to ship illegal immigrants into Oklahoma to be slave labor in the grow. Then they use the profits to launder the fentanyl and coke money, both of the Chinese organizations that are shipping that, their own triad, but also for the cartels. So everyone owes them a favor because they're who takes, you know, $100 million in profits and turns it into several billion in profits that you can sort of legally spend.
Right. And like other organized crime operations, they're diversified. They're in the identity theft business.
Exactly. In one operation, I think my favorite of their operations, they had hackers that hacked into the Texas DMV, and they mailed thousands of Texas driver's licenses to the triad's grow addresses in Oklahoma. And so they could use them to give fake identities to their slave laborers if they needed those. They could use them for identity fraud. You buy stuff on someone's ID, use it for identity theft, or just lots of people in Oklahoma want fake IDs. Here we got some. Let's just sell those, and those are good. So they also launder money for the Chinese Communist Party's elites, which means that the degree of one hand washing the other between the heirs of Mao and the heirs of the Kuomintang. In one way, it's a beautiful story, Robin.
Yeah, it's reunification, if you want to call it that.
If you want to call it that. And then they will do the Chinese Ministry of State Security, their spy organization. They'll act as muscle. They'll keep an eye on people. They'll do favors for the MSS. So in the same way that the CIA turned a blind eye to anti-communist opium dealers in Laos, the MSS turns more than a blind eye to triad weed dealers and fentanyl dealers in America.
But it's not all harmony, Ken, because when there are drugs and drug dealers and money and guns, disputes break out.
Exactly. There is always someone who thinks they should have gotten paid more or sooner. And at the distance from not just Fujian, but Flushing that Oklahoma is, many of these disputes turn violent. In 2020, a guy showed up trying to collect money from some 14K operatives in the Fujian Association, which is the standard sort of benevolent protective association for Fujianese in Oklahoma City. This opened after I left. They did not have one before 1988, but it's there now. And they shot a guy who was trying to collect them their money. And so that drew some eyes to the Fujian Association. And just like in, you know, the 50s, the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation started drawing circles around pictures of people and photographs. And there's another ProPublica article that is nothing but circles on photographs of people who are at the Fujian Association headquarters at one time or another. But the guys who shot that guy were running a grow in Kingfisher County in rural Oklahoma. And this grow had about 100 greenhouses, so it's not a small operation at all. And another guy who they owed money to, name of Chen Wu, drives out there with a gun. And he shoots the boss in the leg and says, I'll shoot him even deader if I don't get 300 grand that I am owed. And it's as though he were somehow in the drug subculture, Robin, because rather than wait around for his ransom, he gets all twitchy and shoots the guy who is bleeding out because he didn't bring a tourniquet with him. And three other workers at the grow, other people fled, and he did not get his money. He jumped in a car and drove off. And the OSBI people who were on the scene said they were wondering why these Chinese businessmen started showing up in cars and then turning around and driving away real fast to the murder scene.
Right.
So anyway, he gets to Miami Beach. Their theory is he's trying to get to Cuba so that he can't be nabbed by the law. But he's arrested because a traffic camera recognizes his driver's license. And so he's snapped up. And he is awaiting trial, as we say. So I guess we have to say he allegedly shot all these guys, but he shot all these guys, allegedly.
Right. And even without murders, these grow-ups are not good neighbors.
No.
You don't want to have them move in next to you. There will be people patrolling with machetes. Occasionally, an enslaved worker will attempt to escape in some sort of horrible condition. So it's not a good situation at all. And
also all the plastic that they use, they don't tie it down because, again, no one involved in this business is disciplined or good at their job. And so the plastic will blow across the fields and the people's cows in the other ranch will eat it. And that's bad for the cows. And yeah, they're just terrible, terrible neighbors.
Right.
These illicit grows are.
And an issue with this is that because this is such an easy to run business without much permanent infrastructure, the cops will bust one grow farm, for example, as happened in Pawnee County in 2023. There's a former racetrack where they're using it as a grow up. They shut that down, and then the cops drive back a couple days later, and they see workers packing up all of the stuff and moving it a couple miles down the road and setting right back up again. And then that's a new case that they have to reopen and start. And so you mentioned the New York City connection, and apparently the funding comes from a network of rich New Yorkers. And the New York Times has accused the big-time real estate developer John Lamb of buying a $1.5 million grow farm as a gift for his protege, Wyan Wang. And now when he was confronted about this, he just, I'm just an unpaid landlord. Just
a charitable humble, unpaid guy.
Landlord. And this is an extra level of interesting, of course, because Lamb was a major fundraiser for Eric Adams, who, as we all know, was the inheritor of the kooky mayor mantle from Rob Ford. And now that he's off the board, we're looking for a new kooky mayor, but that's a digression.
Doors back open for Brandon Johnson to make a run.
Right.
Yeah. And it's also funded by the Chinese Communist Party elites that we mentioned previously. In addition to laundering their money through them, often they will basically buy all the hardware and infrastructure, the chemicals, etc., and ship it over to Oklahoma. There's lots and lots of invoices. And the trouble, of course, is the OSBI is not oversupplied with people who can read Chinese. So they'll capture all these documents when they bust a grow farm, and it'll all be in Chinese, and they'll have no idea what any of it says. And Google Translate, I guess, can only do so much for the brave men and women of the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation.
Right. And the civilian inspection system that is supposed to be checking these licensed grow ops to see if they're
conforming. Right. It fundamentally doesn't exist.
Yeah. It's not really there. So there has been a crackdown. And in 2020, finally, it occurred to someone to put a cap on the number of grow ops, but they're just doing that by attrition of every time they bust a grow op, there's a moratorium, so they can't theoretically are not supposed to replace that with another thing, but that's different than a cap that they could go and actually enforce.
Right.
And another big issue is that drug enforcement is doing a lot of asset forfeiture. And for those of you familiar with that, which of course has a special place in the supposedly good idea Hall of Fame, the thing that happens there is that if law enforcement is seizing bales and bales of money and keeping some of it and turning it over to other government agencies, all of a sudden, the cops and the government are in the drug business. They then have a revenue stream that they don't want to let go of. And so it has been observed by people in Oklahoma who are hoping for more of a crackdown that the legislature has no incentive to do that because, as you said, it's the third biggest industry and there is taxation of this industry in the form of asset forfeiture. So guess what? They're enmeshed in it as much as anybody else.
Old school taxation like the Romans had.
Exactly, yes. So presumably, in addition to this institutional legal corruption, there's probably a level of good old-fashioned corruption that Murray the Camel Humphreys would also recognize.
Exactly. Yeah, and again, Oklahoma has not been run by school marms. Oklahoma has been run by people who ran away from school marms, and that's true since statehood. And the presence or absence of gigantic Chinese triads doesn't make a gigantic difference in the metric of just slip a 50 and see if it goes away situation.
So even now, after the supposed crackdown, a 2023 study determined that Oklahomans who need weed for medical purposes need about 300,000 plants per year for medical use, but that the state produces 24 times that, 8 million plants. So Oklahomans need lots of legal and apparently illegal weed.
A lot of that is also that the medicalization of the marijuana in Oklahoma is very much wink and a nod medicalization. Right. If you have any kind of state ID, which I do not, you can buy weed openly at a dispensary and just like you could buy aspirin at a corner store. And they'll just say, yeah, he probably, you know, needs the weed for his weed problem. And
so do you count in, if you do that, do you count in the 300,000 plants or are you in the 8 million plants?
I think that the people who make studies are being a bunch of fun ruining killjoys and assuming only medical problems count. And if any of them had gone to a state school in Oklahoma, they would know that Oklahoma has, again, a proud tradition of being potheads, that our immediate medical concerns over and above the medical concern of I live in Oklahoma don't address. So I feel like
not all of it is being exported.
All of it is going to China or other states or wherever. Well,
this is why we got a home state correspondent to take this on.
I think a good part of it is going to good old boys who want to take the edge off.
So to turn this into a gumshoe scenario.
Yes.
I think if you do it as an esoterist scenario where there's a monster, specifically some sort of outer dark entity that is, it can just be sort of prowling nearby. It doesn't even necessarily have to have been captured or being used by the grow ops. Or esoterists could be running a grow op to fund their operations. And either they're integrated with the Chinese gangs or they are taking their chances, horning in on the Chinese gangs because they have demons and magic on their side. And so that could either be a red herring where you assume that it's one of the 14K grow ops that you're looking for, and it's not, it's some other organization, or they could be summoning the outer dark, or it could just be a background detail and an additional obstacle that you have to get through in order to get to the creature and neutralize it. And then you can just veil it out saying that, oh yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff that happens in those grow ops. Thank goodness this one's being dismantled.
Lots of people in the operation are also doing ketamine, and God knows what they babble about when they report what they saw. Obviously, the Knights Black Agents connection is that Triad doing all of these kinds of things and trafficking all of these people is a great node for vampires to run because you're bringing in slave workers, bring in a couple for lunch. That's the vampire way. You could also be growing a special strain of weed that has effects on the blood, either makes it taste smooth and delicious, or is the only way that vampires can get high because they don't breathe, and so therefore they can't get weed any other way than by people's blood. So that's just a straight up possibility with that. Any of your monster games, we have both the possibility of Native American creatures that are living in Oklahoma since before the Trail of Tears, coming back because of all this ruckus with the land. You have the possibility of a sort of a John Barleycorn, Children of the Corn type situation where a weed god is arising and he's not best pleased to be blood sacrificed so irregularly. And you also, of course, have all the demons and monsters of the Chinese underworld that they have brought with them, because, of course, where do they come from but their believers and fearers? And maybe you have to go fight them under the giant panda statue down in downtown Oklahoma City on Klassen in the Fujian Association neighborhood.
Well, with all those scenarios ready to go, it's time for us to head on down to another hot Andor segment.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Help this podcast's tiny arms reach the control stick by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
John Buckley,
Scott Stefanski,
Tim Morgan,
Linda and Mike Schiffer,
and Peter Nix.
The whir of the projector, the smell of the popcorn, but there's nothing under our feet because we're not sitting in the theater. We're sitting in the lobby of the Cinema Hut because beloved Patreon backer Mark K wants Robin to tell me more. And by me, I guess he also means me, but he also means Mark. What does Robin mean by the usual structural problems of the cinematic whodunit? And Robin, go take it away. This is your soapbox.
Right. So the difference between the fictional form in which the whodunit arrives, the prose form, and cinema is its relationship to time and the importance of transitions and the cost of transitioning back and forth in time. So that in a book, in one paragraph, you can pop around in time all you like, and a flashback at the end, when the detective explains what happened, first of all, it does not need to be dramatized. You can present that purely as dialogue, and he can be referring to things in the past, and it's perfectly fine. It's interesting. It doesn't have any sort of cost in terms of interest or attention. That is one of the advantages that is baked into the prose fiction format. It's not that transitions don't matter, or that you don't have to lead from one interesting thing to the other, but chronologically, you can pop all around all you like, and explaining something in dialogue is just as vivid and interesting, or possibly more so if you have a great hand for dialogue, or you have a detective who talks in a fun and interesting way, and you enjoy that, having the sleuth recount what has happened. You don't go, what's going on here? There's a disjunction. You don't have to worry about that. In film, however, just as film used to flow through a projector as celluloid and now flows through the projector as a file, it happens in a forward motion through chronology as directed by the director, and everybody's sitting there and enjoying the same chronology in the same way. And whether you convey something through dialogue, through just talking, or through dramatization makes a big difference, has a big impact, which is why you almost never just see an end of a whodunit where the detective stands up there and just says what happened and reveals all the clues. You almost always have a flashback where you often see something that you've already seen in real time, or possibly in ones that use a sort of a Rashomon style and show you things that didn't happen. You may be seeing this a bunch of times. But whenever in film you have a flashback, you move back in time, that is disjunctive. And it feels like, oh, we're not moving forward anymore. We've moved backwards. What's to do with this? There's always a lapse in interest caused by a flashback, which is why using them is generally clumsy, unless it's something that's, you know, totally baked into the narrative. And even then, it often doesn't work. It's really hard to pull off. And so having the detective sort of narrate, meaning that you've then got voiceover, which is another deadly thing that's almost impossible to pull off correctly, over a series of flashbacks, means that the very end of your story is a flashback. A classically engineered film places its exposition at the beginning, gets things rolling. And if you'll notice, most really thrilling, compelling films where that is the point and a mystery is supposed to be thrilling and compelling, you will have very little information revealed in the final act. But a film that is a whodunit has to stop. And the end of the film, the climax, is the revelation of a bunch of information. And so a whodunit in particular, where there's a bunch of suspects and a sleuth who's trying to tell you who did what, is almost impossible to bring off without lapsing into this sort of jagged informational expositional bit at the end. And so I think Rian Johnson did that superbly in a way that is sort of hard to pin down in the first Knives Out movie, and then got kind of rocky in the second one. And the third one, it's like, this is better than the second one, but it still has that problem that even a good whodunit usually has, because flashbacks at the very end, usually kind of deadly.
And I think that the difference between Rian Johnson's three whodunits demonstrates that it's not just that this is a specific kind of film with its own visual language, like watching anime or something. And if you like it, you'll like it. And if you don't like it, you won't like it. That there is actually is this a good movie? Is this a bad movie vector that you have to judge it along? And certainly there are many almost great whodunits in film. And there are some, The Usual Suspects, for example, that manages to make flashbacks tolerable in the course of the film because it's doing other things. And maybe that's part of the secret, is you also need to be a compelling crime drama as well as a mystery in order for the audience to, in this case, the halt and momentum becomes a sort of a deliberate tease, as opposed to to understand this, we have to go back to 2 weeks ago. And so I feel like there are ways and means of dialing around it, or as you mentioned with the first Knives Out, just sheer brio enabling you to sort of bull through it. And a lot of that is also involved in the casting. You have an actor that you want to watch do things that will make you put up with a lot in a way that another actor will not let you put up with it, because you don't care what's happening to that character, whereas you do care what's happening to a different one. So a lot of the things that are around fixing the whodunit don't involve changing the structure, because as you say, the structure is flashbacks plus narration, which is, you know, basically a hole in the bottom of your boat, and you have to row pretty fast and bail pretty hard to get to the other side of the movie river in that craft. Is that right? Basically,
the thing that is being revealed has to be super great, so much so that you forget that you've been thrown back in time through a flashback. And so to name, for example, something that isn't a whodunit but has a big flashback at the end, Ocean's 11. You're super happy when you discover what has really gone on. It's delightful. It's so much better than what you thought went on. But just the revelation of one of these five people is the killer, and here is the method that they used to do this, really depends on a specialized interest in the puzzle. So that if you're really interested in a mystery that is solved by a railway schedule or by the mechanics of a locked room, you will love that film, but you're probably not me also the median film goer. And so most whodunits are kind of interesting at the end, but they're not the brilliant bravura rug pull that you really need to make that work in a film format.
Well, now that we have solved the mystery of the inadequate whodunit, I feel that all we can do is have a flashback and maybe a voiceover. You know what? Instead of that, let's just do an ad and then go into another hut.
The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time to wander once more into that most ill-defined of huts, the one where we're not sure at all what's going on, because there's a guy over in the corner, he's writing a weird historical chronology. There's another dude who looks a lot like him, smells a lot like him, and he's making a weird map. Oh, let's look out the window. There, screaming on the moors, is the alien big cat, which signals as much as the presence of the Nordic alien and the gray alien drinking kombucha in the corner, that we're in the Elliptony hut, the catch-all hut for weirdness, mystery, things that we don't know what we're going on. And we've come across, just now, fresh off the presses, a new version of that most elusive of Elliptonic subjects, the possibly fictional item of American military hardware. Or is it? Or is it not? Because we're here to talk about, people are still good at naming things for everything else that's going on, the Ghost Murmur device. And Ken, the President of the United States of America had something to say about this, and he couldn't possibly be confused or lying. So what did he say?
Our president, in a press conference about the rescue of the F-15 pilot that was rescued from Iran, said it's like finding a needle in a haystack, finding this pilot, and the CIA was unbelievable. The CIA was very responsible for finding this little speck. And then he said that that's not his job to tell you what happened. That's Ratcliffe's job. But if Ratcliffe told you what happened, he'd have to put him in jail. And he doesn't deserve going to jail because he did such a good job.
Right. And that's a CIA director.
Right. Yes. Ratcliffe does say he also was given the same sort of punchy movie slogan notes. He said, with this technology, our airman is still invisible to the enemy, but not to the CIA. If you have a heartbeat, we can find you, which right. combines threatening and cool movie in a way that I feel like the CIA should be doing more often. And perhaps a key to the fact that Ghost Murmur is a bit of a leg pull by the CIA is that the newspaper that broke the story is the beloved New York Post. And the Post gets a lot of stuff right, but the Post also is a fan of what do the people want to read? And what they want to read is about the Ghost Murmur.
Yeah. So if you're a CIA agent who doesn't want to give your scoop to a fun ruiner, You go to the Post.
Right. And they got two sources, two anonymous sources. So the same journalistic credibility as everything that's ever been written about the Trump administration. They said that the Ghost Murmur is a specific military intel application of long range quantum magnetometry. It finds heartbeat signals. It uses AI to sift through them to zero in on one signal. It's supposedly built by the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. It's been deployed on Black Hawk helicopters, and that is presumably how they did it, was that they flew around with the helicopters until the signal locked in, and then they found the guy. The source told the Post, and again, this guy, whoever they've got in the CIA writer's room, man, he's, unlike most people in the CIA, he's doing his job. He says, it's like hearing a voice in a stadium, except the stadium is 1,000 square miles of desert. In the right conditions, if your heart is beating, we will find you. It was about as clean an environment as you could ask for. This is him sort of explaining why it worked. Low EM interference because it was the Iranian desert. It was not that far outside the second biggest city in Iran, but leave it. Almost no competing human signatures because he was up in the mountains. At night, the thermal contrast between a living body and the desert floor, which gave operators a secondary confirmation layer. So you could fly over with infrared sensors and say, is that glowing thing our guy?
Right. Right. So it's easier to find one guy if that's all there is in this vast expanse.
Normally, the signal is so weak that it can only be measured in a hospital setting with sensors pressed nearly against the chest. This is still one of the anonymous sources. Sensors built around microscopic defects in synthetic diamonds have apparently made it possible to detect these signals at dramatically greater distances. The capability is not omniscient. It works best in remote, low-clutter environments and requires significant processing time, which is exactly how you would write it if you put it into a techno thriller.
That's a no beautiful notes. Note of realism being thrown onto this Gallimaufry.
You know, pizza and beer for the CIA writing guy. Well done. And fans of technology and science will recognize this as a technology depicted in the Star Trek episode Court Martial, in which they blank out everybody's heartbeat except for Commander Finney so that they can find him in the ship. But even in Star Trek, McCoy had to be up close to the other hearts to screen out their signal, and it only worked at intra-ship ranges. They weren't able to pick out your heartbeat from 40 miles, which is what Trump said the range was. So even in the 23rd century, they don't have Ghost Murmur Robin. So how proud of America are you now? Very. Just to give you a scope of the problem, a human heart's magnetic field is 10 to the minus 12th Teslas. So we're in the picotesla range at 1 meter. And at 40 miles, that would be on the order of 10 to the minus 26th Teslas, which is to say octillionths of Teslas. Magnetic fields break down by the inverse cube law, which is even worse than the inverse square law. And quantum magnetometers mostly use something called the superconducting quantum interference device, or SQID, to read the magnetic fluctuations in the heart.
That's the writer's room again. They spent a whole day on that.
Well, this is the writer's room of hospital tech, and the cardiomagnetic field extends outside your body, so you can do magnetocardiography, as it's called, without having to go inside anyone's heart or even necessarily use those sticky things, although they do use the sticky things. The SQID's sensor is at around 10 centimeters. The room is electromagnetically shielded. This technology goes back to 1963, when they were able to use just regular magnetometers, not even SQIDs. They came with a theory of SQID in 1970, and by the time superconducting and CAD software took off, they started putting supercooled magnetocardiography devices into hospitals. I think the Germans started adopting them in the mid-2000s. And then now, a SQID system is around 280 kilograms and can fit under a hospital bed. So you just go and you lie down on it and they can squid you up just fine. But science does not stop, Robin. There is a even better tech called OPAM, optically pumped atomic magnetometers, which use IR lasers, infrared lasers, to measure the magnetic field. And that's tested tech by 2014. It's built into a wearable magnetocardiogram system, which is basically a 95 millimeter plastic disc, and it holds 8 OPAM coils strapped to your chest. And that's, you can buy that right now. That's out in 2025. And that can detect femtotesla level, 10 to the minus 15th. So we're moving towards it, magnetic fields. And in 2023 paper, someone demonstrated that OPAM can measure magnetic vector potential, and this is the real game changer. And this is, rather than read a straight up magnetic field, they can read the change in the magnetic field over distance. And so you may not be able to say this is where it is, but you can say it's stronger in that direction, like the locators in Aliens, speaking of science documentaries. DARPA has a whole program called AMBIENT, which is an acronym that even I find too stupid to spell out, so Google it if you care.
Right, okay. Well, but now that you've said that, everyone is lunging to their computers to look it up, and there's two I's, but I'll save the trouble because I've looked it up, and it stands for Mental Organism Designed Only for Killing.
Exactly, only for killing. And DARPA's AMBIENT program does that outside laboratory conditions. They did a field test in 2022. This was a public field test, and that got to the several meters range, so you're talking about moving it even farther along. And that was in a building in a city, so under the opposite of an Iranian mountain conditions.
Right. And you're not in a helicopter.
Right. The tiny flaws in artificial diamonds reference from our CIA source refers to nitrogen vacancy magnetometry, NV magnetometry, and it uses tiny pits in the diamond to produce luminescence. And this technique measures magnetic fields down to the nanometer level, and it doesn't seem super good for long distancing because you need the diamond to be up close to the person. And so NVM, as far as we know, can go down again to the femtotesla level. So that is what the tiny flaws in artificial diamonds are. And unless they've somehow slaved an NV program to this AMBIENT system, I think that the NV may have been the CIA guy doing exactly the Googling that I did to find out what's a cool way to measure magnetic fields in the heart.
Right.
And more, by the way, work than the Scientific American did. I had to find this out on my own.
On the streets.
On the streets like an animal. So if we're fun ruining this, there's sort of two guesses, one that is sort of close to what they said and one that is not remotely close to what they said. There is something called frequency modulated continuous spectrum radar, which a regular radar just sends out pings, boop, 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 and measures the distance between the pings. The frequency modulated continuous spectrum radar sends out a beam and changes the modulation of the beam and then measures the distance between the modulations. And a FMCW radar can hear a heartbeat at 3 meters. So that's something. FMCW LIDAR can measure nanometer variations at 300 meters. So, and that's in 2025. Quantum FMCW LIDAR, which is the name of the best lawyer in Star Trek, I guess, seems to solve some of the problems with regular LIDAR. And two Chinese papers in 2025 give nanometer resolutions at 25 meters. And these are the publicly available papers on this stuff. So who can say? Maybe they've slaved the quantum FMCW LIDAR through the nitrogen vacancy diamond system, and they've just pumped in an unthinkable amount of power through it, which you can do if you're the government, Chinese or American. And then the ultimate fun ruiner answer is everyone sleeps on the fact that the pilot also had a beacon, that they were carrying a beacon.
Oh, no. Ghost Murmur. You were here for such a short period of time in our lives.
And the beacon is made by Boeing. And the beacon, in theory, just says, hey, I'm here. Hey, come on, get me. But a possible way that the beacon could be individualized and made better, and therefore have to be secret, is something called direct sequence spread system transmission. So you split the signal into many, many frequencies, and you use a large pseudo-random number to determine which frequencies and how much of a split. And so someone with a matching number can pull the signal out of the floor of the ambient electromagnetic field. So in theory, it just goes to sleep in the just radio noise of the Earth, but it's still making the signal, and if you've got a good enough compute, you can pull it out. And so the original DSSS patent is from 1942, invented by a Swiss guy who gave it to the British. But obviously, by now, compute is much, much bigger. Beacons are much, much better. So in theory, a pseudo-random number could be so large that no one without military spec AI could pull the signal out ever. And so it would be basically an invisible beacon. And maybe that's what they don't want to let people know that we have. And so they made up a cool ghost murmur. But I do remember reading that the guy had a beacon and saying, did we need a second explanation for how they found him? I mean, isn't that cool enough? He just activates a beacon and suddenly everyone is there from the army. It's just nuts. Or Air Force, I guess. Right. Whatever.
Yes, that does seem like the thing that really happened. But if you have a super advanced version of that, it does seem like also the sort of thing that you would create a cover story around to confuse things, because a member of any search party from any country where you have a downed pilot, if they're wasting their time thinking about the ghost murmur, they're not going to try and isolate the signal from a beacon. And even a less fancy beacon that someone else could detect is exactly the sort of thing that you would need a ghost murmur cover story to get in the way of, right?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, even if all they did is just fly a Black Hawk helicopter around the mountains south of Isfahan listening for the beacon, it's still ideal that the Iranian government not know that you're doing that. For example, we know that they just lied about where the guy was shot down. You know, you could see maps on Twitter or your news program or whatever showing that he was all the way over in Khuzestan province and that's where he was shot down. And turned out, nope, it was literally the exurbs of the second largest city in Iran that he was hiding out by. And I assume that they lie about location just like they lie about everything else in order to keep that guy safe and alive. And I certainly, you know, I'm not mad that anyone made up ghost murmur. As I've said before, I think that's the CIA doing what it ought to do, is come up with amazingly cool stuff to make us sound terrifying.
Right. It's doing our work for us. So, yeah. So to techno-thrill this up a bit, you could posit then that it's possible to record someone's specific heartbeat and come up with a ultra-quantum ghost murmur that can detect people in much noisier environments. And so it becomes your ideal tracking device for finding a particular person. And so that gives you two things for your agents to go and do. First, you have to get close enough to the target to record their heartbeat with the super-duper quantum heartbeat recorder. And so that could be your whole mission, is just get a recording of their unique heart signature, or be the person trying to hunt them using this device, so that you know you can find them, but you have to keep close enough to them and avoid all of the other people trying to protect you from them. So
right.
You could either have the hit preparation scenario, making the hit or the grab, or, you know, do one and then the other.
Yep. And between the ambient and the quantum FMCW LiDAR, we have a, you know, publicly known open range of, call it 20 meters for this heart detector. But I think 20 or 25 meters is actually kind of ideal for role-playing purposes. So if you are Knights Black Agents freelancers, maybe that's the sort of thing you can get by doing a heist on a medical facility. If you are connected to a really big, powerful intelligence operation, China, America, Israel, then yeah, you've got the good one that can do it at 100 meters or even at a kilometer. It still can't do 64 kilometers. That you've got to ride it around on a helicopter for. But a kilometer is pretty good if you're looking for a single heartbeat. And even right. 25 meters is frankly pretty good if you're looking for a single heartbeat.
Now there is a wrench in this. If you're looking for a vampire,
yeah.
No heartbeat. So what signature sound, because presumably this can lock into any sound and then search for that sound, right? It doesn't have to be a heartbeat. What is going on in the body of a vampire that you would want to get an audio recording of to use to track them that would be unique?
Well, and that depends on your type of vampire. So if it's a silicon vampire, you have a sort of a scraping noise instead of a happy thud. If they're a bat or an animal type vampire, then they have a high pitched thudder noise instead of a proper heartbeat. If they're from hell, then maybe their heart sounds like a magma or a molten rock pouring over something. And so there's sort of a rumbling hiss noise that it makes. And then the fun part is, when you're using your rumbling hiss detector to find a vampire, and the guy who's supposed to be doing your parallax so that you've got two beams pointing the same way says, all right, I've got him. And you draw the line on the map and they don't cross. And it's like, oh hell, there's two vampires. That's not a good moment.
Yeah. It's like that bit where they all light up in Aliens.
Exactly.
And there's a whole bunch of them. Well, now that there's a whole bunch of vampires, it's time for us to get out of here. So
yeah.
I think we can, quickly wrap up this podcast and flee to wherever vampires aren't, perhaps sunlight, but we'll be back into the darkness a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Palgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Shield this podcast's heartbeat from synthetic diamond defects alongside such backers as...
Philip Masters.
Randy Shipp.
Ryan Lassiter.
Adam Balderstone.
And Ben Brigoff.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.